From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In a major policy turn today, President Bush plunged into a conflict he has struggled to avoid, announcing he will send Secretary of State Colin Powell to the Middle East next week. In a dramatic Rose Garden address, Bush called on both Israelis and Palestinians to step back from the violence that has escalated so dramatically.
During the course of 1 week, the situation in the Middle East has deteriorated dramatically. Last Wednesday, my special envoy, Anthony Zinni, reported to me that we were on the verge of a ceasefire agreement that would have spared Palestinian and Israeli lives. That hope fell away when a terrorist attacked a group of innocent people in a Netanya hotel, killing many men and women, and what is a mounting toll of terror.
And the terror has mounted to stunning levels. Over the past 18 months, more than 1,500 Palestinians and Israelis have been killed. Secretary of State Colin Powell's new mission is as daunting as it is urgent. An immediate ceasefire, Israeli withdrawal from Palestinian lands, a jumpstart for the peace machinery of the Tenet and Mitchell plans. For months, President Bush's position remained firm. The U.S. would not engage until the Israelis and Palestinians themselves made the first steps toward peace. Now, amid so much bitterness and blood, is it too late for the U.S. to step in? Does even Washington have the clout to bring peace to this stricken region now? We begin this hour in Jerusalem. Harvey Morris is a reporter with the Financial Times. I spoke with him earlier. I asked him how Bush's statement has been received by Israelis and Palestinians.
Both sides are reserving any official judgment for the time being. I think Shimon Peres, the foreign minister in Israel, has welcomed it, but not in any very specific terms. The Palestinians also have said that they're studying the speech. Unofficially and off the record, the Israelis seem somewhat more encouraged by it than the Palestinians do, because they think that it doesn't really call upon them to halt the military operations that are happening at the moment, at least not in the very short term.
Well, how about that? What is the interpretation that you see emerging of President Bush's call on Israel to begin withdrawing from the recent incursion?
I think the Palestinians would probably have liked a statement which said, withdraw immediately, don't go any further from now. They probably would have liked the Colin Powell visit to have been starting tomorrow rather than on an undefined day next week. I think they're looking at it as a sort of green light for Israel to carry on maybe for a few days longer to see what they can do.
And from Israel's perspective, is a few days more enough to complete the work that they set out to do with such determination last week?
When this whole operation started, there was a perception, which was encouraged by Israeli officials, that they would need a month to do the job. There was nevertheless an acknowledgement that probably they would get 10 days grace from the United States. So who's to know? There is fighting continuing in the West Bank. The operation is clearly tougher than many might have expected, although the Israelis have rounded up 1,100 people who they say are suspects. The whole situation is a bit too cloudy at the moment to see whether it will have the results which Ariel Sharon promised.
Harvey Morris, you've seen President Bush's statement. Does it read like a statement that's in touch with what's going on in Israel and the West Bank, or more like something for American political consumption?
I think the problem with it is that ordinary Palestinians, I mean, people who have no connection with armed factions or terrorists or anything else, will say to themselves, look, we're under siege at the moment. We've got no food, we've got no water, the electricity is cut off, we've got bullets firing all around us. What are you going to do for us? And he's sort of saying that everyone in this situation is a victim of terrorism. Now, that's certainly a very valid point of view, but I'm not sure that if you're holed up in your cellar in Ramallah or Bethlehem that you necessarily see it that way.
And does the repeated condemnation of terror resonate in Arab nations?
Well, I think, again, it wears a bit thin when we know that Yasser Arafat, for all his faults, is stuck in two rooms in his headquarters. So, therefore, maybe he hasn't done enough in the past, as President Bush said, and maybe he has more to do in the future. But at this immediate moment, I think anyone would acknowledge that it's very difficult for him to do anything.
The American press is tending to interpret Bush's statement as a shift from pressure on Arafat to pressure on Sharon. It doesn't sound as though it looks that way from where you stand.
Clearly, there's a shift in the sense that President Bush has decided that he really has to become engaged in this situation because it could run out of control. There's problems on the Lebanese border. You know, it could really turn into something even more serious than it is now. But one could say that there's been a shift by the president since the passing of the UN Security Resolution 1402, I think it was, last week, mm-hmm. to which the United States put its name, which was for an Israeli withdrawal from the territories it's occupied. And what President Bush said today went along with the spirit of that resolution, but it didn't say, come on, you've got to do it now.
At this late hour in the conflict, is there a sense in the region that President Bush's change of posture will make a material difference?
There is a certain amount of hope that with Colin Powell eventually being dispatched to the region with considerably more clout even than Anthony Zinni, the U.S. Middle East envoy, maybe there's a possibility of sorting something out. But I fear that the actual situation on the ground at the moment is so grim and gloomy for both sides that optimism is not the first word that springs to mind.
And Yasser Arafat, will he be meeting with Zinni? Will he be meeting with Colin Powell?
I think the plan is for General Zinni to go and see him tomorrow. The Israelis gave the go-ahead for that. As I understand it, when Colin Powell arrives, he will not be seeking the permission of the Israelis to go and see Arafat. He considers that is taken as read, that he will come here so that he can see both sides. There won't be a situation in which the Secretary of State of the United States arrives in Israel and then asks the permission of Ariel Sharon to travel to Ramallah. I don't think that will occur.
It could be pretty thin hospitality that Yasser Arafat is able to give in his two rooms.
Well, that's true. I mean, they say they're running short of water and food and that the electricity is intermittent. Unfortunately, given that the Israelis have declared all these cities closed military zones, even those journalists who've got in, and we've all managed to get into some of these areas over the past few days, it's very difficult to actually go and determine exactly what's happening there.
And finally, Harvey Morris, is there a sense among Israeli forces that, in fact, they may have diminished Palestinian capacity to dispatch suicide bombers? Has there been a lull in that activity?
There has indeed. There have been no bombings for 3 days, but I don't know that necessarily proves that they won't happen in the future. After all, the Palestinians are on the defensive, and, you know, they're fighting on their own territory at the moment.
Harvey Morris is a reporter with the Financial Times in Jerusalem. So, Secretary of State Colin Powell leaves sometime next week. Today, a delegation from the European Union abandoned its mission, stalled out in its attempts to bring a ceasefire. Will Colin Powell have better luck? After months of refusing to get involved at the top level, has the United States lost its clout in the Middle East? And what exactly is the United States committing to with this new stance? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me tonight from Washington, D.C. is Ambassador Ned Walker. He's president of the Middle East Institute in Washington and was Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs from 1999 to 2001. He's served as U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates. Good evening and welcome, Ned Walker.
Well, good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Ned Walker, you have written that President Bush needs to knock some sense into these two recalcitrant enemies. Do you think his statement today and the action that's supposed to ensue from it is enough to knock some sense, in your words, into the Israelis and Palestinians?
Well, it is an excellent statement. It was a good measure on the part of the president. The knocking of the sense will come through the actions of the Secretary of State and backed by the president. So it'll be a process, not just a one-shot deal. But, yeah, this is a very good start. I'm not that optimistic, but on the other hand, where were we headed before this?
We want to go through the president's statement today. He had a lot to say. Some of it new, some of it old wrapped up in a new way. But I guess at the top, I wonder, what do you see as particularly powerful in what President Bush said today, and what do you see as largely posturing?
Well, first of all, what's powerful about it is that he said it. I mean, this is a change in the position of the administration, and particularly a change in the president. He is coming out strongly now saying that we've got to get engaged. We've got a huge problem out there. It is affecting our relationships with the entire region. And he is saying that he's sending his top diplomat, the Secretary of State, out there with his blessing to do something. What happened in the past when the secretary went out, there was a question mark as to whether he had the full backing of the president. There was some second guessing from the White House about statements he was making. Mm-hmm. He didn't have the authority. Now he's got very clear authority. Comes out on the podium there, standing right next to the president. Nobody can mistake what he's coming out there with. He's coming out with the power of the United States behind him and with the president of the United States behind him. That hasn't happened before. It's great.
Once again, President Bush lashed events in Israel and the West Bank into the general war on terror. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
We mourn the dead. And we mourn the damage done to the hope of peace. The hope of Israel's and the Israelis' desire for a Jewish state at peace with its neighbors. The hope of the Palestinian people to build their own independent state. Terror must be stopped. No nation can negotiate with terrorists, for there is no way to make peace with those whose only goal is death.
President Bush, this morning in the White House Rose Garden, Ambassador Walker, what do you hear in the president very powerfully pulled in the anti-terror, the war on terror theme into this speech? There are many audiences for this speech. Who is the terror message aimed at, and how will it play?
Well, for one thing, it was an extremely strong statement and a very good one as far as I was concerned. It's aimed at the people in the region. We just had a Organization Islamic Conference meeting in which they seem to support terrorism. I think that's got to be turned around. And one of the roles that Powell has got to have out there is when he goes out and talks to Mubarak and he talks to Crown Prince Abdullah, King Abdullah, and so on, is to get a very clear statement from these leaders that terrorism, that is the slaughter of innocent civilians, doesn't fly.
But I had a little sense listening to the president today of the great Caesar passing down the word that terror will no longer fly. But does saying that translate into action? Is there a receptive audience on the other side in the Middle East?
Look, I think that the people in the Middle East, particularly the leadership of the Middle East, wants this problem to be backed down, to get the violence under control. Let's face it, the long-term losers in this whole battle are going to be the regimes or the moderates in the Middle East. Every time you have terrorist acts, every time you have violence like you have now, it just builds the number of people that are prepared to give up their lives and to sacrifice themselves in terrorist operations. It enhances the role of the radicals, enhances the role of Muslim fundamentalists, and it is creating a danger and a risk for every country out there.
So you see him not ordering an end to terror, but appealing to reason that terror doesn't work for people there.
Well, that's exactly what I think that the United States should stand for. I think the president is standing for that. not only does he, but he say that terror doesn't work, but he's also saying that you can't solve the problem of terror through military means. So that's the other side of that equation. That's why this is such a good statement.
That's the message to Israel. Ambassador Ned Walker, please stand by. We're going to take a short break. We're talking about President Bush's new stand on the Middle East, articulated today in the Rose Garden. Are you heartened by the president's new stand or not? Is U.S. involvement essential, or does it just muddy the waters? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about President Bush's new stand articulated today on the Middle East. And we're asking, are you confident that the United States still has the sway to make a decisive difference in the Middle East? Is Bush's move too little too late? Or has he taken the sting out of an Israeli effort to use violence to fight violence? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are joined by Ambassador Ned Walker. He's president of the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C., and was Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs from 1999 to 2001. Ambassador Walker, we were talking about terror in the Middle East. There's been a lot of talk lately that the Palestinians have discovered in suicide bombing a weapon that they believe works and is working for them, that it's creating terror in Israel and has even raised hopes of a banishment of Israel from the region. Do you think that the president's message will get through to people who may think that suicide bombing is working in their interest?
Yeah, it's a real problem because I think this thing all developed, the biggest problem developed out of the Lebanon situation. When Israel left Lebanon in the face of Hezbollah attacks on the IDF, a lot of people in the Palestinian and the Arab world took that as a message that if you hurt the Israelis enough, then they will be they will make compromises. Now, that was the wrong message, and it was exactly the wrong lesson to be learned, because for one thing, Israel was in an area that it already had said it had no intention of staying in, it had no commitment to Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, it was strictly a attacks on the IDF, not on civilians. And so it's a huge difference. Now, once you start attacking civilians, terrorism and so on, the kind of you, every Israeli becomes an opponent. Every Israeli stands together, and understandably so. And they all support the prime minister in the most aggressive stance that he can take. So it's totally counterproductive. It is destroying the hope of a Palestinian state.
Ambassador Walker, let's listen for just a moment. We'll come back to this, but to President Bush on exactly this point today.
I call on the Palestinian people, the Palestinian Authority, and our friends in the Arab world to join us in delivering a clear message to terrorists. Blowing yourself up does not help the Palestinian cause. To the contrary, suicide bombing missions could well blow up the best and only hope for a Palestinian state.
President Bush today in the Rose Garden. Ambassador Ned Walker, you took the terrorist theme and went to Lebanon, but keep it right current with us in the Passover bombing and the other bombings that have caused so much destruction and fear and anger in Israel. There are clearly Palestinians who think that they do have a winning strategy with these. Take us through the logic, the argument of why it's a no-win strategy.
Well, first of all, the Palestinians who think it's a winning argument are those who want to destroy the state of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
They also want to destroy the Oslo negotiating process. They want to destroy the hopes of making peace and having a two-state solution. So let's keep in mind who's doing the terrorism. But also, the fact is that this terrorism is going to make the Israelis far more obdurate in their position. It's going to ensure that the Israelis never feel confident about a two-state solution. It's going to ensure that the American people, as you can see in the Congress today, are going to be the 100% supporters of Israel. And it's going to work to the disadvantage of the Palestinian movement and Palestinian cause for years to come if it continues. There is only one answer. They've got to stop this.
But
it's a policy tactic.
Mm-hmm. You're making a clear distinction there between Palestinians who think that this terrorism can bring an end to the state of Israel and those who don't. But President Bush, in his own remarks today, cast doubt on which side of that line Yasser Arafat stands. He said the chairman of the Palestinian Authority has not consistently opposed or confronted terrorists. Anthony Zinni is supposed to be sitting with Yasser Arafat in his unsplendid isolation soon, and perhaps Colin Powell doing the same next week. But on what basis do you anticipate the U.S. will be talking with Arafat at this point, when he's been declared an enemy by Sharon, when he's been so isolated?
Well, there's no question that Arafat has been on both sides of this coin and has a very checkered record when it comes to terrorism. He has never stood up and said clearly that this is something that has to stop, and that's one of the objectives that Colin Powell has to have. But we have to deal with Arafat as the symbol and the representative of the Palestinian people. There is nobody else to deal with.
However ambivalent that symbol may be.
No matter how ambivalent that symbol is or how frustrating it is to deal with him. I've had that experience.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just talk to nobody. You can't talk in the air. So there's got to be somebody. There's got to be a point of contact. He is it. He's the one the Palestinians have chosen and continue to claim represent them, but it's not enough to talk to Arafat. We have got to have the support of the Arabs. This is a key point from the administration.
Mm-hmm.
What the president was saying is that we can't do it alone. We have to have President Mubarak. We have to have Crown Prince Abdullah. We have to have King Abdullah and others that can support our efforts in there. Make it very clear to the Palestinians that terrorism is not the answer. The answer lies in negotiations. The answer lies in supporting the President of the United States.
Ambassador Walker, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation now Jeffrey Kemp. He's the former director of Middle East Arms Control Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and currently director of regional strategic programs at the Nixon Center. Good evening and welcome, Jeffrey Kemp.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Jeffrey Kemp, we know that there have been strong conservative voices inside the Bush administration and outside saying it's the thing to do is to continue to stay out of this, is let the Israelis deal with this in a strong fashion, that negotiation got the Clinton administration nowhere and it won't get the Bush administration anywhere either. What do you think happened to that voice, that line in the debate over what President Bush should say today?
Well, that voice actually reached a crescendo yesterday when a group of neoconservatives, wrote a letter to the president essentially saying, don't deal with Arafat, deal with Saddam Hussein, and we'll back the Israelis all the way. And then Bush comes out with this statement today, which in my judgment is a if you want to talk about victories in bureaucratic politics terms, I think this is a tactical victory, at least for Colin Powell and the State Department, who have been very concerned about the growing isolation of the United States, both in the Arab world, amongst our allies, and in the European community, and elsewhere.
Jeffrey Kemp, you've been right in that kind of circle. You were a security advisor to President Ronald Reagan. How do you think this played out inside the White House? This is a departure for the Bush administration. There are active opponents of this posture. How do you think it came to pass?
Well, my assumption is that they took one look at some of this television coverage from Cairo and Amman and Beirut, and now from India and other countries where there are either a Muslim majority or a strong Muslim minority.
Mm-hmm.
And, he's got Mr. Blair coming this weekend to talk about Iraq. And the problem is you cannot focus on Iraq, even with close allies like Blair, let alone the moderate Arab leaders, unless there is some satisfaction that the Arab-Israeli conflict is going to be diminished and a peace process of sorts is going to be started once more. And I think that view has probably won out in the short run in the White House, rather than the view which the neoconservatives have been pushing, that is to say, you cannot resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict at this point in time because the Arab regimes are too corrupt and autocratic.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to the heart of the problem, which is Baghdad, get rid of Saddam Hussein, and then you will see, you know, a sort of a cleansing in the Arab world, and it will be easier then to make peace with Israel. So I think you've got these two very strong competing points of view, and because of the overwhelming television coverage and phone calls the president's been getting, I think he had to do what he did today.
But you describe what he did today as a tactical move, not necessarily a fundamental shift in strategy. We'll watch how that plays out. Jeffrey Kemp.
Well, it is a strategic move because once the president says it, it's on the record.
Well, it is that. Jeffrey Kemp, Ned Walker, please stand by. We've got callers who want to join us. Let's invite them in. Aaron is on the line. Welcome, Aaron. You're on the air.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
I'd just like to say that I think President Bush made a huge mistake today.
How so?
Well, I think what he did today was essentially to step back in a big way from what people have been calling the Bush Doctrine, which is a policy of zero tolerance for those leaders that are going to support or allow terrorism to emanate from their territory. That was, I think, the lesson that people had learned from, that the Taliban learned in Afghanistan, that if you support or harbor terrorists, we are going to make you pay for that choice. And I think Yasser Arafat has shown time and time again that he is, at the very minimum, not willing to crack down on terrorism emanating from his territory. He's not even willing to...
Aaron, what do you think the consequences of that step will be, in your view?
Well, President Bush's step today?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that it's going to hurt us around the world. I think it's limited the extent to which people are going to believe that the United States was serious about taking on terrorism as a global problem.
Aaron, thank you for your call. Ambassador Ned Walker, how about it? Aaron says he wishes the Bush administration would have stuck with the zero-tolerance policy. He sees this as a step away from that. Will this be persuasive in the Middle East, or
no,
will
first,
this...
Look, first of all, Aaron, the administration, Secretary Rumsfeld, all of them have said all along there are different ways of dealing with terrorism. One answer that you might have is the Afghanistan model. Other answers might be different in different countries. There's nothing that the president said that in any sense walked away from the fight against terrorism. There is nothing in what the president said that in any way justified the actions of Hamas, Islamic Jihad, the Al-Aqsa Brigades, or anything else. What he's trying to do, and I think it's a reasonable and appropriate thing to do, is to get the parties to back away from this so that we can actually deal with the issue of terrorism. The problem is that the more violence you have, the more people that are willing to go out and be victims in the sense of self-immolation and engage in terrorism and so on. It's not a winning proposition. Even the Israeli generals and members of the Shin Bet think that you can't win this by military means.
Mm-hmm. Rafat is on the line. Welcome, Rafat. You're on the air.
Hi, Carl. What I think, I'm going to make my comment short as possible. What I think is of the Mr. President's speech today,
yes.
There's no change. There's nothing new. What I mean is that by the double standard policy and the bias toward Israel is still there. It didn't give anything new to the Arab citizens, which is, I think, the American administration is ignoring that the Arab population, the Arab people, not the government, not the leaders, but what the Arab people.
Yes.
I'm originally from Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
My wife is American born, but she is her family. They are from Ramallah.
Okay.
From Ramallah, and that's what we hear. I was in Jordan last week. I just came a week ago from Jordan, and I asked the people, my friends, which they're all educated and all the things. This is what the attitude towards the American policy. That's what they think.
And you don't hear enough today to change your mind on that front, Rafat.
Excuse me?
You don't hear enough today from President Bush to change your mind. It still sounds pro-Israeli to you.
And I'm sure that the Arab population, they're not going to change their mind about the American policy and about what's going on. I give you an example for that today, which is the first time in the history of Saudi Arabia, a demonstration starts in Saudi Arabia. While there's a law against this in Saudi Arabia, but the people ignore this law and they go into demonstration against what's going on.
Rafat, we've got your point, and thank you very much for making it. I want to get the response of our guest, but before we do, let's listen to President Bush speaking here, not to the Palestinians, but to what he expects of Israel.
Israel faces hard choices of its own. Its government has supported the creation of a Palestinian state that is not a haven for terrorism. Yet Israel also must recognize that such a state needs to be politically and economically viable. Consistent with the Mitchell Plan, Israeli settlement activity in occupied territories must stop. And the occupation must end through withdrawal to secure and recognize boundaries, consistent with United Nations Resolutions 242 and 338.
President Bush in the Rose Garden today. Ned Walker, Rafat, our caller, is saying that kind of language is not strong enough to offset the Arab public perception that the U.S. is very biased in favor of Israel. What do you think?
Well, it's not going to offset the public reaction at this point, but although I have to say, I must say, I don't think that Rafat really listened to the president. This is an extraordinary statement for a president of the United States. Never have we had a statement about settlements quite like this from a president of the United States.
Never? Not even from Bush the senior?
No. Never quite like this. This was a declaration of American principles that we are not going to put our interests on the line for the settlements. That's basically what he was saying. And that's a huge difference. And frankly, I think the president deserves a lot of credit for what he's done. I think it took courage. I think it takes courage to engage in a high-risk operation like this where there is certainly no guarantees of success. But I do think that if he hadn't done it, then there were certainly guarantees of failure.
Jeffrey Kemp, I want to ask you, the Bush administration has been so critical of the Clinton administration's efforts in the Middle East, made very clear they did not want to go down that same path. And yet Colin Powell is headed out there, and it's all about negotiation and getting around a table. We're talking Tenet and Mitchell again. Can the Bush administration avoid the same sort of a fruitless effort that the Clinton administration got involved in?
Well, of course, for the first 4 years, the President Clinton did not get deeply involved in the peace process. He left that to the Secretary of State. He got very involved towards the end in a very intense and personal hands-on way, not seen since Jimmy Carter was president. And it may well be that if George W. Bush gets reelected towards the end of his second term, he too will get deeply involved. But presidents, by and large, don't like to get involved hand-to-hand, one-on-one, early on in an administration. And that's why I think he quite correctly made a very bold speech today, but sent Colin Powell to the region and did not volunteer himself.
But what is there that will be different in negotiations this time? Has the terrible violence of the last 18 months changed the chemistry in such a way that U.S. intervention may be effective, may really get things on the track where people would like to see them who want the peace process reinstated?
Well, the huge difference, of course, is that between Bush becoming president and his speech today, you had September the 11th and the linkage now between a war we're fighting in Afghanistan, our desire to topple the regime in Iraq, and the clear linkage between progress on the terrorism front to the east and the crisis now to the west on the Mediterranean coast. So he's got to deal with both these issues. You cannot postpone one while you're dealing with the other. They have to be looked at simultaneously. But I think in terms of the dynamics of what's happening today on the ground with the coverage that we've talked about before, he has got to at least show that he's involved deeply in the peace process. And he does that best, I think, by sending the Secretary of State out there.
Sometime in the next week, the Palestinians wish it was right now. The Israelis have a few more days, it looks like, before Colin Powell shows up. Question is, what constituencies did you hear President Bush speaking to today? Is President Bush being realistic, or are we headed back into something insoluble? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about President George W. Bush's new stand on the Middle East, articulated today in the Rose Garden at the White House. We're joined this hour by Ambassador Edward Walker. He is president of the Middle East Institute in Washington and was ambassador to Israel, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates. And by Jeffrey Kemp. He's director of regional strategic programs at the Nixon Center. You can join us, too. Are you confident that the U.S. still has the sway to change the course of events in the Middle East, in Israel, and in the West Bank? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. President Bush was not shy today about saying that many parties have a role to play here. He spoke to Israel on that front about friendship and responsibility, and also to the Arab world.
To lay the foundations of future peace, I ask Israel to halt incursions into Palestinian-controlled areas and begin the withdrawal from those cities it has recently occupied. I speak as a committed friend of Israel. I speak out of a concern for its long-term security, the security that will come with a genuine peace. As Israel steps back, responsible Palestinian leaders and Israel's Arab neighbors must step forward and show the world that they are truly on the side of peace. The choice and the burden will be theirs.
Ambassador Ned Walker, the president, saying there that the choice and burden will be that of Arab neighbors and Palestinian leaders. But there's a burden for Israel here, too, because he's saying stop this incursion, which Prime Minister Sharon has been very committed to, and pull back just when Israelis were wanting to, you know, clean up, as they would describe it, a nest of terrorism. How do you expect that these burdens that he's putting on both sides in this conflict will be perceived and accepted by the Arab world, by the Israelis?
I think there's a good chance that the Arab world understands that, you know, with the president engaged now, they're going to need to support him. They've been calling on him in very graphic terms to engage and to do something about this problem. Now they're going to have to give him a hand. They're going to have to help him. This is totally consistent with the approach the president took right from the beginning of his administration and his conversations in the NSC and elsewhere. He expects people to work with us, and he expects us to work with people. It makes us a much stronger partner in this whole process.
But are the Arab leaders free to do that, given the kind of outpouring of rage we've seen in Arab streets? Do they have the leeway within their own political framework to be forthcoming in helping the U.S. in this effort?
They have the frame. They have the leeway and the framework in the context of the what the president was saying. Part of the rage that has developed over a period of time now has been the sense that the United States was walking away from this problem and the sense that the United States was identifying 100% with Ariel Sharon.
Mm-hmm.
What the president did today was put himself put some distance between himself and between that perception. Now, that will give a certain amount of leeway to the Arab leaders. And most of them, I mean, you've got to remember that the Saudi foreign minister on leaving Beirut after the summit said that, you know, terrorism, the killing of innocents, suicide bombing is not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is not a new message from these people, but it's one they need to reiterate, and it's one that Arafat needs to iterate.
Mm. Jeffrey Kemp, Ned Walker, let's get one more call in. Rashadi is on the line. Welcome, Rashadi. You're on the air.
On the Internet.
Hello, Rashadi. Are you there? I think Rashadi is ordering dinner. We'll skip that. Jeffrey Kemp, we hear Ned Walker saying he thinks it's time. He thinks the Arabs will step up. What about the Israelis? There's been a very great determination to go in with a strong response. And there are, of course, politicians, Benjamin Netanyahu among them, who would like to be even more forthcoming with a military response to the Palestinians. How do you think this call to stand back will set in Israel?
Well, there'll be a clear debate about it, but the Israeli government, that is to say Sharon and his cabinet, will be, I think, very gracious and supportive of Bush, because they know how that the United States is the one ally they have and the one ally they cannot in any way alienate. So, there'll be a debate. There'll be a lot of people in Israel who say the very fact that Bush made this speech was essentially a concession to terrorism. It shows that terrorism pays off, and therefore, you know, we have this has been a round that we may win tactically because we'll capture a lot of terrorists, but in the long run, it sends the wrong message. And so there'll be a debate here, there'll be a debate in Israel, but by and large, any Israeli government has to take very, very seriously what a president of the United States says, because We are Israel's one friend that is absolutely vital to their security and to their political future.
But we note, Ned Walker, that today Shimon Peres did not comment on this call for withdrawal. He said he was happy for Bush to have joined the effort to bring out a ceasefire and welcomed Colin Powell, but there was no comment on the withdrawal front.
Yeah, but the Labour Party has a difficult position that they're in. They don't want to be seen to be undercutting the Prime Minister or the coalition government. On the other hand, they will have a say in what happens, and politically, their continued cooperation with Sharon is essential to his survival politically. So I would expect that that there will be the reaction that Jeffrey has talked about. They will indeed support the President of the United States.
Ned Walker, our time is running down, but just in a few seconds, how significant a step toward the possibility of peace do you read today's statement as?
I think it's a major step in the right direction. I think it is the right decision by the President of the United States. I think he's taking leadership where leadership was needed. And I hope that it increases the possibilities of bringing the violence under control.
And Jeffrey Kemp, we've just got 15 seconds, but do you think...
I concur with what Ned Walker said. I agree with him. I think this was bold and necessary, and the timing was right.
And the politics of it for George W. Bush?
Tickled, but he can overcome it.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey Kemp, Director of Regional Strategic Programs at the Nixon Center, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And Ambassador Ned Walker, now President of the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C., thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Check out the latest news from around the world. It's on our website. Go to onpointradio.org. Up next, a Croatian novelist talks about her life in exile. This is On Point. Croatian-born novelist and essayist Dubravka Ugresic writes that exile is the only country without a geography. It has, however, a climate, a culture, ecology, and archaeology, a virtually national smell. Ugresic knows exile. In the early 90s, after speaking out against the Croatian president Franjo Tudjman, she was vilified, denounced as a witch, and forced into exile. It's been 10 years this week since the siege of Sarajevo and the beginning of the wars in the former Yugoslavia. Here, Dubravka Ugresic reflects on the weight of life and of exile.
I no longer live in my Zagreb flat, nor is my Zagreb flat mine any longer. All I possess now is a suitcase. I do not use my suitcase as a metaphorical substitute for the word exile. The suitcase is in fact my only reality. Even the stamps which have accumulated on the pages of my passport do not convince me sufficiently of the reality of my journeying. Yes, the suitcase is my one fixed point. Everything else is a dream, or perhaps I'm a dream dreamt by someone else. It doesn't matter which anymore. When nationalism started, when Slobodan Milosevic started with his famous speeches raising the Serbian self-esteem, I quite spontaneously I couldn't look all of what was going on just like that, and quite spontaneously I wrote several essays. Those essays were published in foreign press, which means they were published first in German newspapers in 1991 and 1992, after what I have been attacked by Croatian media, by Croatian press. I was quite heavily ostracized as a result, and life became quite impossible because I was proclaimed a public enemy, a traitor of my nation, a witch even, and I decided to leave the country, and that happened in 1993. From there on, I'm living abroad and At the moment, I live in Amsterdam, and it seems that Amsterdam is going to be my home, my permanent home. Through all those years, I felt really an urge to write. I tried to express my feelings, confusion, sorrow, sadness, melancholy, fears, in the novel, which title is The Museum of Unconditional Surrender. In that novel, there is a very short definition of that condition called exile. These are the words of Joseph Brodsky, who called exile a condition. An exile feels that the state of exile has the structure of a dream. The dream is a magnetic field which attracts images from the past, present, and future. The exile suddenly sees in reality faces, events, and images drawn by the magnetic field of dream. Suddenly it seems as though her biography was written long before it was to be fulfilled, that her exile is therefore not the result of external circumstances, nor her choice, but the jumble of coordinates which fate had long ago sketched out for her. Caught up in this seductive and terrifying thought, the exile begins to decipher signs, crosses, and knots. And all at once, it seems as though she were beginning to read in it all a secret harmony, the round logic of symbols. Recently, I was thinking about The Wizard of Oz. I was thinking about the movie. So clearly, I could imagine the last sentence from that movie pronounced by Judy Garland, which says, the most quoted and the most famous sentence probably in the history of quotations, there is no place like home. But it seems to me that this sentence, there is no place like home, Dorothy pronounces it just to somehow to please the adults, because she wants to tell them the story, how it was beautiful in Oz. But as we all remember, the adults surrounding her, they do not want to listen to. They just said, okay. And then she pronounces that sentence, there is no place like home. But she pronounces it with a certain, slight disappointment, just because she's a decent girl. So just to please the adults. In this sentence, at that point, in fact, starts Dorothy's exile. And as we perfectly know, after pronouncing that sentence, there is no place like home, Dorothy will have many adventures in following Frank L. Baum's books. So I think that this is the answer. Yes, there is no place like home, but we are not going to go back because we are going to search for some new Oz.
Croatian novelist Dubravka Ugresic. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.